Welcome to Let's Talk Learning Disabilities with Lori Peterson and Abby Weinstein. Lori and Abby spend their days talking about dyslexia, dysgraphia, dyscalculia, and ADHD. They talk to parents of struggling students and adults who have had a lifetime of academic challenges. They want to share those stories along with their own insights with you. So, let's talk learning disabilities.
Everybody, welcome to Let's Talk Learning Disabilities. This is Lori.
And I'm Abby.
And we are super excited today. We have Betsy Williams from Top Pediatric Therapy. She is an occupational therapist, and she's going to tell us, we're going to talk all things occupational therapy today. So I'm super excited. So welcome, Betsy.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. We are very happy to have you. So we're going to start like super top level, easy. What is occupational therapy?
So the basis of occupational therapy is actually that word occupation. And an occupational therapist can work with anybody over the lifespan. But being a pediatric occupational therapist, we work with the occupations that a child has. So the occupations that our kiddos have are motor, so play activities, gross motor, fine motor activities, walking, running, climbing, coloring, buttoning, things like playing with peers, so social skills would fall under an occupation of a child. School occupations, so handwriting, being able to sit in a chair and listen and focus is an occupation that we work on as well. Following directions, anything that a child would do daily, brushing their hair, any kind of grooming tasks, getting dressed. So any daily occupation of a child is what I, as an occupational therapist, would work on.
So tell us a little bit about your center.
So our center, we're located up in Frisco, Texas, and we are considered an outpatient clinic, but we work from a sensory integrative theory. So we look at a kid holistically. We look at their basic sensory systems and decide from there what we need to work on occupation-wise. So, you know, a parent may have a kiddo come in and they're having a hard time focusing in school, and we might find that they have very poor body awareness. So we may work on body awareness so that they can improve their focus in school.
What about for, like, the younger kids, like your preschool and your kindergartners? I mean, you probably have parents with a whole host of concerns, right? Not just their school performance, but it could be things like being able to cut their food or color. Button their pants
or cut with scissors.
Yeah. Right. A lot of times with our little ones, our preschoolers, we get maybe the pre-verbal kiddos that aren't able to make their needs met verbally. And so they may get attention in inappropriate type of ways, throwing themselves down, screaming, having temper tantrums beyond the 2 and 3 year old temper tantrums. Mm-hmm. And so we may get parents that call us because they just don't know what to do with this right. Tantruming child.
Mm-hmm. Behavior issues.
Lots of behavior. Hitting in school.
Oh, really?
Biting friends in school, things like that are all very input seeking types of behaviors for our little guys, but also frustration because they're not able to talk and make their needs met. So we would work with that child on, again, improving body awareness, and then also probably recommend speech.
What do you mean by body awareness? What is that exactly?
Well, so when we talk about, when I talk to a new parent, a lot of us, when we're in school, we learn about our five basic sensory systems. So vision, smell, taste, hearing, and touch. But we also have three, actually, internal body senses. One is our proprioceptive sense, which is a big word, but that's basically our body awareness. So I'm able to know where my body is in space because I'm getting constant feedback from my muscles and my joints up to my brain to tell me where my body is. So I can talk to you guys. I know that my hands are up in the air because I use my hands a lot when I talk. My left leg is crossed over my right leg. My right foot is firmly on the floor. My back is against a chair. I don't have to look to know where my body position is because my muscles and my joints are constantly giving feedback to my brain. And then my brain receives that information, tells me if I feel comfortable or if I don't feel comfortable, and then I have an appropriate, hopefully, motor output considering the situation.
Right.
So that's our proprioceptive sense. Our another internal sense is our vestibular sense, and that is our receptors are located in our inner ear, and that's my relationship with gravity. So am I sitting upright? Am I falling out of midline? What's my right side of my body doing versus my left side of the body? That's my, how am I moving? So body proprioceptive is body position. Where am I? Vestibular sense is how am I? How am I moving? What's my body doing? And
so are those kids that are often like off balance or uncoordinated or falling out of their chairs? Or
struggle with knowing where they're at?
It can be both. Okay. So the thing about sensory integration is it is just that, integrating our senses. So that's kind of what we do. We will kind of weed out, is it a vestibular problem where their little body is not understanding what's being fed to their vestibular system and they are either seeking out more input, or on the flip side, we have a lot of kids that are very sedentary and they don't like to move. And they may have, we call it gravitational insecurity, where they get scared when their feet are off the ground.
That's so interesting.
Or they're up high or whatever. My son, actually, we used to go over overpasses, and he was very firmly in his chair, but he would just freak out because he was up so high. And that was definitely a vestibular issue with him. But then on the flip side, you may have a kiddo that is able to climb up, and as long as their feet are firmly intact, vice versa. They may be, they need their feet for that input, for that body awareness. We call that postural insecurity. So for a kiddo that may not like to swing, it may be because they don't understand where their body position is.
Because their feet aren't.
Because their feet aren't on the ground and they're not getting that input from the ground.
Interesting.
Which is why, you know, positioning with all of our occupations are very important for our kids.
Mm-hmm. So how do you work on improving that? Or once you determine which senses, right, or systems you want to work on, then can you give a couple of examples of kind of things that you might do to help with the vestibular or
proprioceptive?
Yeah, good. Nice. You even said it right.
You did. Good job. So a lot of times with our proprioceptive system, we're working on just getting them enough of that input. So we do a lot of climbing. So climbing, jumping, wheelbarrow walks, any kind of animal walks, anything where they're working their muscles and their joints to improve strength, to give as much input as we can to their muscles and joints so that hopefully their little brains start receiving it. And then vestibular-wise, we may start off with very little vestibular for a kiddo that has vestibular processing differences. And we may, if it's a kiddo that really is having a hard time with movement, we may give them a lot of that proprioceptive input first, get their little bodies better regulated proprioceptive-wise, and then do small increments of vestibular until we can give them more and more and more, and their little brains are learning how to process it.
So when I think of like sensory processing issues, I think about kids who don't like loud noises or who don't like textures like the tag or the socks or whatever. So where do those fit into those systems?
So in general, proprioceptive types of input are very calming in general. And so for a kiddo that may have an auditory processing or maybe hypersensitive to noise, then we would recommend doing more proprioceptive types of input to kind of calm their nervous systems. A lot of times they're so worried about what noise or touch or visual impairment is going to make their bodies feel bad. So if we can give them proprioception, but then also work on the whatever specific sensory system is giving them the most anxiety, then that can get better. But there are specific programs for auditory differences that we use as well.
So basically, all the kids that you guys see, one of those systems is being impacted, but it shows up in different ways.
Yes.
So talk to me about, like, what are the symptoms that people come complaining about that then you can address with through one of these symptoms? Like, what are the frequent things? And I know it's really different with different ages, but still kind of what are the most common?
It is. So we, and with each sensory system, it can look sure. very different because we have kids that are hypo, which means they're low. They need more, more, more of that type of input. And we have kids that are hyperactive to it. So they get just a little bit of that input and it causes disruption as well. So we would see, so like for a kiddo with tactile processing differences, we typically get the ones that are hypersensitive to different textures. Mm-hmm. Or on the flip side, we may get a kiddo who likes to wear long sleeves in the summer.
I was just gonna say, what the opposite of that is.
Yeah.
I've seen
so
that.
Like they just want more of that tactile.
Or they're constantly touching you and pulling you onto mm-hmm. them and hugging you.
Exactly. Or they don't have good awareness of, I mean, it's kind of body awareness too, but they don't have a good awareness of personal space. Mm-hmm. And they're very, very close to their peers in the lines at school and they get in trouble for touching and pushing and pulling. And so it may be a kiddo that looks like that. Vestibular wise, we may have a kiddo who does not like to move. Who is our sedentary kiddo, and those kiddos often get overlooked because they're so good.
Mm-hmm. Right. They look like they're doing what they're supposed to
do. They do their work, but they may have a hard time at PE because they have a hard time running. But as long as they're good and they're quiet, then they
Nobody
can get
cares.
Overlooked. Yeah. And now on the flip side of the, so that type of kiddo would be a hyper responsive kiddo to vestibular types of input. And then on the flip side, you have your hyporesponsive kiddos that can't sit still. And those are the ones that get into trouble. Maybe, you know, the hyperactive part of the ADHD kiddo who is constantly on the move and constantly seeking that vestibular input mm-hmm. for
can't sit
whatever
still.
Reason. Uh-huh.
So what would you say is the most common concern you hear of parents calling in, or does it just vary? I mean, is there a most common concern that you're hearing lately? People seeking
it's
out.
It's funny. We kind of go
therapy.
Through these phases. I feel like we've had a lot of tactile kiddos that have come in recently, and I feel like there's also been an upswing in anxiety,
mm-hmm.
Which is not
thanks to the pandemic.
Uncommon.
Yeah,
we've seen an upswing in anxiety mm-hmm. as well,
and so. So that those have been like the big two, I would say, recently.
Do you feel like that so many kids are learning at home now that they're not developing some of those systems the way they should because they are have been more confined? I mean, it's getting better now.
More sedentary.
They've been more sedentary and more confined, so maybe some of those systems aren't developing.
For sure. I think screen time mm-hmm. is a huge concern in our kiddos in general. But I think with the pandemic, there have been there've been much more opportunity, understandably so. I was a parent that had to get work done and
right.
still sometimes has to get work done. So my kids are very happy with iPad and TV.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just
what it is.
Exactly. So, but I do feel like there's less opportunity for movement.
Right.
Because of the pandemic.
So what are some of the academic concerns from some of these system interruptions, whether it's hypo or hyper? What are some of the things that play out in a school setting that you see?
The big one that we get is handwriting. Mm-hmm. So parents that whose children have
illegible,
they're, you know, all over the paper.
So which
large.
System is that?
It's a combination.
Okay.
There's a visual piece to it, obviously.
Sure.
There is a tactile piece. And then the big one is that proprioceptive sense.
So, oh, really?
Mm-hmm. So position and how that ability. So like a handwriting copying, you have to take a picture from your brain or from the screen and then have a motor output that looks just like the picture that is in your brain or on the board. And so to do that, your body has to know where it's moving, how it's moving,
mm-hmm.
body position. So, but then you also have to have that visual processing piece. And then,
right.
Which is important as well.
And I guess to be able to hold the pencil correctly and form the letters correctly and move your hand across the line, across the page, that is, you have to have that body awareness as well, right?
Body awareness. And the big thing I think that we see is, so the way we develop is from central to distal. And a lot of times our kids are not, they're not confident in their core. Their core isn't as strong as it should be to have a nice, good foundation for our writing. So we need to have a nice, strong core, nice, strong shoulder, nice, stable forearm. And then when we write, we typically stabilize with our pinky and our ring finger. And then our hope is that we have a nice, good, dynamic tripod grasp to push and pull. But a lot of times what we see are kiddos that are stabilizing in their hand.
Like a fist grip.
And with a fisted grip, or even like putting a lot of pressure on their the tips of their fingers. So that causes handwriting to hurt.
And so that could be a weak core muscle? I mean, theoretically.
It could be.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That is interesting.
I mean, I also feel like handwriting is
a lost art.
Very, very early too. Mm-hmm. And kids aren't really ready. So they start with a poor grip from the beginning, mm-hmm. and then they get into these poor habits, even when core may be where it should be, mm-hmm. but they get into these poor motor plans and these poor habits with writing, and those are hard to break. So mm-hmm. I wish 3, 4, and even 5-year-olds were really working more gross motor,
right?
And maybe like tong work, you know, so working on those pre-writing grasp skills mm-hmm. Before we were pushing letter writing, but that's just not our world right now either.
No, not at all.
So what other services do you guys offer at Top Pediatric Therapy? I mean, are you all occupational therapists, or are there other types of service providers?
We do provide speech therapy as well.
Okay.
But we're mostly OT. We have seven OTs that are there. Wow. Partially or more full-time, depending on the therapist.
And are they all doing the same types of therapy, or do you guys have specialty areas? Or?
Yes, we all kind of work from that sensory integrative standpoint. I would say I do have some therapists that may be a little more biomedical than, like, I'm maybe more regulation and really truly sensory. Mm-hmm. But we all do have a good foundational knowledge of sensory integration and you know, using our sensory systems to get the goals met that we need to get met.
And then we were poking around on your website and looking at the different kinds of stuff that you guys do. And we noticed there's some like IM therapy, which is interactive metronome therapy, social groups. And there was another therapy.
Listening center.
Thank you, for the listening center. So can you just touch on each of those a little bit?
Sure. So social groups, we actually don't have any running right now. I need a new speech therapist. We just don't have enough speech. But we were doing speech kind of social groups.
Okay, yeah.
And we used a lot of the Michelle Garcia Winter curriculum, the social thinking curriculum, and had a really good success with those. So, but we've also done like sensory motor social groups and focused on regulation in a group.
Mm-hmm. So what would that look like? Like as far as knowing where you fit physically in the group or being able to do an activity?
All of the above.
Okay.
Yeah, kind of all of the above. So that, we use a program called the Zones of Regulation, which is Lisa Cooper's, I believe. I'm going to hopefully not get that wrong. She's got a really great program that talks about where is my my arousal level? Uh-huh. Am I green? Am I just right? Am I able to follow directions and feeling calm and confident in my body? Am I yellow zone? Do I have increased anxiety? Do I have extra energy? I'm having a hard time focusing. Mm-hmm. Am I blue zone? Do I have low energy? Am I tired or sick? Or am I red zone? Am I out of control? And so what we like to do, and we do it in our OT sessions too, is teach the different zones and also teach, you know, how that individual child is feeling in each zone. Mm-hmm. And we let them know that there's no bad zone. There are appropriate times to be in all levels. We don't really want to ever hang out in red, in that out of control zone, but we teach them, how are we feeling? How do we identify it in ourselves and others? And then what types of sensory input is going to work best for that child to help with regulation.
Depending on what zone they're in.
Depending on what zone.
So are you teaching them to become self-aware of their zone and then to kind of advocate for what they need to help them with that zone?
Yes.
That's exactly. Very cool.
That is so cool.
And for the ones that can, and for the ones that may not have the ability yet based on developmental age or chronological age, then we teach it to parents. And it kind of gives parents like so this situation is causing little Johnny to be in yellow zone. Let's try this type of activity, see if we can pull him down. Or sometimes it's, pulling him out of the activity.
Mm-hmm.
And then regrouping and calming and then trying it again. So,
we mentioned interactive metronome in a previous podcast when we were talking about processing issues and different types of processing issues. And so what is something, or how do you guys use interactive metronome therapy in your center? And what do you address with interactive metronome?
And how do you explain it? Because we may not have done a great job. I mean, you obviously would be an expert. So can you explain it a little bit and then how you would use it?
Good point.
Yeah. Well, I always send parents to their website.
Me too. Okay,
because
good.
They explain it better than I ever can. And it's a different type of therapy. And I tell parents it's a tool in our toolbox. I use it very differently than a speech therapist would use it versus a biofeedback therapist might use it. So depending on the child that I work with, if we're working on attention and focus, then I'm looking at the duration of time that child is able to do the activity and keep it within the time constraints that I need him to do. So, and I don't know if that answered really that question, but interactive metronome is a computer-based program that uses a metronome beat set at the typical tempo is 54 beats, but that can be modified based on the child's impulsivity or even ability to move.
Mm-hmm.
We can make it faster, make it a little bit slower. And it works on rhythm and timing, attention and focus. And we use it, so if I have a kiddo that may have attention and focus issues, I'm looking at doing an activity for a certain duration. But I've also used it for kiddos that have a motor planning issue. And I want them to get into that rhythm and timing to be successful with a certain motor plan. So
that's interesting.
So we use it different ways.
So one of our questions that we wanted to find out was, can occupational therapy help individuals with ADHD? And it sounds like there are many different factors involved in occupational therapy that can help with attention and focus and sustaining that attention.
Impulsivity,
hyperactivity.
Mm-hmm.
Hypoactivity.
I really think talking about the zones, back to that piece, where that helps with that, because so many ADHD kids lack self-awareness.
Right. And self-regulation skills.
Even into adulthood.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So to be able to, be more aware of, to put a name to it or a color to it or whatever, that to me is huge.
That is huge. To know exactly, become more aware of what's going on with your body. And
how you feel.
And how you feel. And then what you can do about it. If you're being too hyperactive, what are some strategies that I can do to help myself lower my activity?
Or is it my environment, right? If doing this activity, I'm a yellow, but this activity, I'm a blue, why? And how do I alter?
Right. How do I change it so I'm successful?
Yeah. That's.
And it also gives clinicians and parents and teachers and students kind of a uniform language to talk about
child
and their arousal.
Right.
Yeah. That is awesome.
That is awesome. So what are some other common conditions, I guess, quote unquote, or disabilities that you work with and that occupational therapy can help?
I'm all kinds.
It sounds like
our center basically. Our biggest population that we work with would be autism spectrum.
Because of sensory.
Because mm-hmm. of sensory. And a lot of those kiddos are over-processing, under-processing. And so there are a lot of underlying sensory needs that their little bodies need so they can catch up.
Mm-hmm.
And on the flip side there, they also have all these wonderful splinter skills.
Right.
That we're trying to kind of get the holes caught up in between So we do see a lot of kiddos that have some type of learning difference, mm-hmm. whether it's a dysgraphia or an ADHD or a dyslexia.
Probably for the younger kids, more yeah. like
the little guys
eating and swallowing and
we do
delays.
Uh-huh. And the little guys, when they come in, they may not have a diagnosis, except that they just may be behind a few months. And their pediatrician just wants them to catch up. We do see some, random babies with torticollis.
What is that?
It's a shortening of the neck muscles because of positioning, which we love to get, because if we can fix them at 3 months old, then, and just educate parents on the importance of tummy time, the importance of crawling, hitting all those developmental milestones, then we won't have to see them at five.
Right. So. Yeah. I have a quick question. Amanda asked this earlier. At what age do you determine hand dominance? Or is it different for everybody?
I because of the push to write
at
an early age, I really try to get them to have a dominant hand by five, but sometimes kids just don't.
Mm-hmm. And so what does that mean, or does it mean anything?
Sometimes we do have true...
ambidextrous.
Yes, true ambidextrous kiddos, or kids that are... they are just gonna write left-handed, but gross motor is all right-handed. Sometimes it's a crossing of midline issue where the kids just, if I put a crayon on the right side, they're gonna pick up with the right hand and use that, and that goes back to our vestibular system. Or if I put it on the left side, they're gonna pick it up with their left hand and use it. And that is an issue, because we're not able to cross midline and really pick a side to mm-hmm. use, or just using whatever. So that's kind of an immature.
That's interesting.
Nervous system type of behavior. And if with that kiddo, I wouldn't necessarily push a hand, but I would definitely work on crossing midline.
Because eventually then they'll pick the hand. Because
eventually they'll pick the hand.
That makes sense. You let them make that choice.
Right.
Whatever feels right.
What gets tricky is if, they're coming to me and I'm letting them use whatever, but then at school they're making them...
That's right. I think a lot of teachers are forcing them to pick a hand mm-hmm. and parents too. And then I'm curious, can you change their pencil grip? I mean, is that something that's hard to do? I mean, once they're in, let's say, first grade or second grade and they still have an inappropriate pencil grip, is that something that you can change?
It's changeable. The kiddo has to want to change the grip.
That's the big one. They have to want to do it.
They have to want to do it. So, and if they have, a lot of times when we start changing a grip, then their writing
changes
and mm-hmm. isn't as good as they perceive it should be. And so they'll go back to their old grip, their old inefficient grip. But I just, try to remind them that, in the long run, it's going to be more efficient. You're going to be able to write longer. You're going to have better endurance. You're going to have less pain in your hands, mm-hmm. And things like that. So it's doable, but it really, the kids have to want to do it.
Handwriting is so hard right now because of technology, right? And I think it's frustrating because we do have so many kids that are fluent at the hunt and peck. So they don't have the home keys or whatever, however we learned how to type. Mm-hmm. They can hunt and peck like nobody's business. And so it's like, well, parents don't want to push handwriting because they're typing. But at the same time, I feel like it's a developmental skill you really need just as part of your process of developing language and your writing skills.
Right.
You really can't skip that, can you?
I don't think so.
No.
As an occupational therapist. But, I guess a lot of times schools, parents, teachers, if the kids are functioning and getting their work done whatever way, then they'll take it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do think handwriting is very important as far as like motor planning and the fine motor development.
Right.
And can it be improved? We actually diagnose a lot of clients with dysgraphia that have illegible or very, very poor handwriting. So is that something that, can it be improved through occupational therapy?
I think it can.
Okay.
I know it can. I've seen it done.
Okay.
Because a lot of times, dysgraphia is a real diagnosis, of course, but through motor planning and teaching and reteaching and practice and repractice, then those motor plans can change.
It's like going back to the root, right? Going back to the sensory stuff.
Right.
Going back to the root and figure out why.
Exactly. Is it a postural control issue? Is it a fine motor strength issue partially? Is it a visual spatial issue?
We see that a lot.
Right. And you know, we do too. And so we would also, you know, maybe share with developmental optometrist or, you know, like, let's go look at this portion of it, see what they have to say, and then we'll, you know, incorporate some of their goals and activities into what we're doing. And as
how much does your stuff overlap with like a vision therapy kind of thing?
A lot.
I would say quite a bit, right?
I refer a lot, I would say.
But don't you do some of the same activities, would you say?
Yeah? We do, but if I have a kiddo that that maybe will have been in OT for a couple of months and I feel like there's still some significant visual attention or ocular motor or just perceptual-wise, there's something I'm missing, which just happens a lot.
Sure.
And I'm very happy to get
a second opinion.
Yeah. For vision and also for auditory. I send...
Oh, that's true.
Referrals for auditory processing disorders. So you start with an evaluation when they come to you, and that kind of determines your course of treatment and therapy?
Yes.
They do an evaluation?
We do standardize as much as possible. Gross motor and fine motor evaluation. And then we have a whole list of clinical observations that we're looking at. The parents fill out a sensory questionnaire based on behaviors that they're seeing at home. And then we kind of put everything together and say, based on what you're telling us, you know, we only see them for an hour and a half. So sometimes our snapshot isn't the truest picture.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So a lot of it's gleaning information from parents and their concerns. And sometimes they work much better for us. Sometimes they work much worse for us.
True.
But just based on parent information and information that we get during that session, then we make a course for treatment.
And do you see kids normally like once a week, twice a week? It just depends.
It depends. Depends on a lot of things. Their level of need.
Sure.
Insurance. Yeah. We do take insurance, but it can be limiting at times. Schedules are also very limiting at
sure.
times. So it just kind of depends. But I would say most of our kiddos come twice a week initially, and then we try to fade them back to one time.
And would you say like your initial plan for kids is usually like 3 months, 6 months? I know that can completely vary by the...
We usually say 6 to 12.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
Yeah. We like to evaluate 6 to 12 months, depending. And if I have a kiddo that is just flying through and I think we're going to get them done in 6 months, that's great. I would say most of our kids are with us at least a year.
And do they ever need to... So you have somebody graduate from OT at 6. Is there ever a time down the road that they're going to need to come back for any kind of like tune-up or...
We've had some come back. You know, it just depends on...
The skill.
Their skill, yeah.
Exactly. So I'm curious... you're in a clinical practice, you know, private practice. How is school-based occupational therapy different from clinical-based or private-based occupational therapy is one question. And then the second question would be, why is it that there are so many kids that struggle with handwriting at school, but they don't qualify, they are not found eligible for occupational therapy services through the school?
Those are good questions.
Sorry to put you on the spot.
No, I love our school OTs that we work with. We do a lot of collaboration, and there are some really wonderful OTs in the school district. I think they are very overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of need in the school district. Their goal is for that child to be functional at school. So if it doesn't matter if they have a gross grasp, as long as their handwriting is legible, they're functional.
Okay.
And that's okay. They're performing up to grade level or
that's
whatever.
Their occupation, right? Like they're that back to what we talked about at the very beginning, they're making it happen for
they're
their
maintaining
occupation.
Their occupation.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And so as long as they're functioning in school, then they don't necessarily need occupational therapy. So we look at it a little bit different. A lot of times, you know, there are regulation things going on that that we want to work on, or motor skills. And a lot of times the skills aren't a big enough deficit to maybe cause them to not be functioning in school. Mm-hmm. But if we can just catch them up a little bit and make them more confident, then mm-hmm. they're going to perform even better in school. Mm-hmm. But that's not the school's. The school's job isn't to make them be the best
that they can be.
It's for them to get through their day and to do everything at a functioning level.
To pass,
in my opinion.
A deficit. Well, you're right, though, because a deficit, and I think a deficit is there's always a differing opinion, right? What somebody in the school or what a parent might see as a deficit, the school's like, it's fine. Like, it's not that big of a deal where the parent thinks it is. So there, it makes sense. And I think they're completely overwhelmed. There are too many kids that do need support. Right. So they really do have to kind of pick the worst off or the greatest needs.
Right.
And address those first, yeah.
That are having the more visual dysfunction in school.
Right.
That makes sense.
To help them catch up.
So school, they just need to make sure that they are functioning fine, good enough, whereas your goal is to have them functioning to the best of their ability, right?
Right. The reason we named TOP is it stands for transforming our potentials.
Oh,
and
I like
so
that.
If I have a kiddo that is performing, you know, at level 6, if I can get him up to level 7 or level 8, then that's my goal. I want him to be the best that he can be.
That's awesome. I love that.
That is awesome.
So to the best of their potential.
So is your certification a national certificate, like to get to your licensure? Is it a national licensure? Is it done per state? How does that, how does it work to become an OT?
Licensing is per state.
Okay.
We go through the Texas, I can remember, executive board or whatever, to keep our licensing up.
So if you wanted to work with us, if you wanted to go to Oklahoma and work with someone there, you'd have to have your license, your OT.
Yes.
For Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
So when people are outside of Texas and are looking for a pediatric OT, it's kind of self-explanatory. You would find somebody who's got the right certification, works with kids. I know, even just looking at other cities for some of our clients, I have a hard time finding people that talk about handwriting, which is interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like that, to me, is one of the more common things, but sometimes it's harder to find anyone that either specializes in it or really feels comfortable.
Right. There are two really wonderful handwriting programs that we use and are familiar with. One is Handwriting Without Tears. And again, I cannot think of who did that one. The other one is First Strokes by Jan McCluskey. So she's here in Plano.
First Strokes.
We'll put those in the show notes. We'll put links to both of those.
Yeah. So, so you can always contact those. I know Jan is probably doing virtual, you know, if a parent is
probably
out of state.
You're right.
But I don't know. That's a Jan question. Sorry, Jan. but her program is amazing. And then, you know, have a parent maybe look to their websites and see if there's a practitioner that specifically is working on in their area. The other thing I tell my parents to do is, actually, I just had a friend of a friend who lives in Miami, and they were in town, and she had a little boy, and I said, you know, I don't know, I'm not a diagnostician. To me, he looks like he's doing great. Does he need speech? Probably. It's not going to hurt him. OT is not going to hurt him. Let's just, you know, catch up those skills a little bit. But I said, you know, look into your mommy groups, your Facebook mom groups. She wasn't 100% happy with the person that her doctor sent her to, and that's fine. You know, we all have opinions, but I know that my moms know a lot more than I do a lot of times.
That's
and
a
so,
good idea.
So if you can find a mommy group or a daddy group, for whatever you're looking for, then a lot of times you can get some good information.
Good referrals from there. Yeah, I didn't think about that.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
That is a great idea.
But I do like the idea of those handwriting programs because I know I'm familiar with both of those, and Handwriting Without Tears I know is used across the country. So there will be people that are using that.
Yeah, I know Frisco ISD uses that. So we use it a lot in our clinic, but Jan's program is really great too.
Are they teaching cursive again? I know we took cursive away for a while, or some districts did. I feel like cursive is really important for handwriting because of the flow and the, I don't know, I just think it's easier for our dysgraphic kids.
It is.
Mm-hmm. And so is that something that, do you guys ever work on cursive with the kids?
Or we rarely work really on cursive.
It's really like a huge undertaking,
I
would think.
If I get a kiddo that just is not getting print, then I'll do like loops and other groups and, you know, and do a cursive program with them. you know, and then just as far as motor planning, there's just one way to go, right?
Right. You have to keep on moving.
Keep moving to the right. And so it is an easier, I think in a lot of ways, it's an easier way to learn. But then you have to, the visual side of it
looks
different from the print that we read. And
you've got to read it.
Yeah.
I do think schools are teaching cursive again, because I've seen several students recently that are writing in cursive and practicing cursive. So I think
it went away for some reason.
Yeah, I think it ebbs and flows. They sometimes it's in the curriculum, sometimes it's not, but they've start implementing it at third grade usually. But I know that a lot of the dyslexia therapy programs teach those kiddos cursive because it is easier for the individuals with dyslexia to write in cursive as well.
Connecting the sounds and the flow.
Right. So it's cool. That's good to know that it is easier for dysgraphic individuals as well.
Makes sense. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for being here today. This has been great. We're going to put your information in the show notes along with those handwriting programs and anything else that you think might be helpful. We'll add in there as well. If you guys have any questions or have any topics you want to hear, please email us. letstalklearningdisabilities@gmail.com. Otherwise, have a great day. We'll be talking to you with our next episode.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thank you so much for joining us today. In our show notes, you can find information about today's talk, as well as links to resources and other episodes. If you have questions about today's talk, have ideas for future episodes, or just want to stay connected, you can contact us through Diagnostic Learning Services on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram. So, let's keep talking learning disabilities. This podcast is sponsored by eDiagnostic Learning. You can find more information at www.ediagnosticlearning.com.